Hello, and welcome back to the Dante in a Year podcast. My name is Danny Fitzpatrick. It's been 2 years since we began our initial journey through Dante's Inferno, and 1 year since we concluded with the final vision of the Paradiso. Today, we begin a 2-year journey through Dante's great epic once again. Once a week, I'll repost our original recordings of the poem itself, and I'll also post a new episode commenting on that particular canto. These commentaries will not, of course, be exhaustive. Their primary focus will not be on the historical and political context of the poem, though these subjects will undoubtedly come up. Rather, our aims will be first to study the poem as poetry, to see how it moves us musically and fits into the poetic tradition, and second, to reflect upon the spiritual journey of Dante the Pilgrim and how that journey has shaped the Catholic imagination. One new feature this time around is that we are taking subscriptions from those who would like to become sustaining members of the podcast community. If you enjoy Dante in a Year and would like this project to continue to flourish, I invite you to contribute on a monthly basis. I'm deeply grateful for any amount you can share, and those who subscribe at a level of $25 per month or more will receive a gift. More details on that soon. I've posted the link to our subscription page in the show notes. And now, let us once again turn our attention to Dante's Inferno, Canto 1. The poem begins on a note both scriptural and classical, universal and personal. In the midst of the journey of our life, Dante says, "I returned to myself through a shadowy wood, for the right way was barred." On the one hand, the text recalls the words of King Hezekiah in Isaiah chapter 38, verse 10, "In the midst of my life, I will go down to the gates of the netherworld." It also, by way of the psalmist, gives us a way of dating the poem. If the span of a man's life is 80 years, then the midst of life would fall, for Dante, in the year 1300, when he was 35. The poem begins, many scholars think, on precisely March 25th, 1300, a date scripturally auspicious. Not only is it the date of Christ's conception and crucifixion, but it is also held to be the date of the creation of Adam. We might also recall St. Augustine's gloss on Genesis 1, in which he describes in principio as meaning in the Word, the Son being the beginning of all things. He is, likewise, in the midst of all things, the one in whom we live and move and have our being, and it is only through him and in him, ultimately, that Dante returns to himself. Dante, called to union with the new Adam, Christ, has lost his way, and so he must, like all good epic heroes before him, descend into the underworld. Before embarking on the journey itself, however, he laments the misery of his situation. Ah, how very hard it is to tell the way of that wood, so savage and harsh and strong, the very thought of it renews the fear. Dante does not begin, as Homer does, with the divine wrath of Achilles or the cleverness of Odysseus. Rather, in a poem which becomes one of the wildest and most ambitious flights of human imagination ever conceived, he begins with an experience all of us know very well, that of having lost our way. The universal scope of Dante's work is reflected in that phrase, nostra vita, our life, which is nonetheless made particular in the I of the second line. Looking about, Dante can hardly recall how he arrived in this wood, which seems to leer at him like a desolated Eden, so filled with sleep was he when he forsook the fine way. In this sleep, and the sudden waking which follows it, we hear again echoes of Adam's life. We might imagine, for instance, the tremendous surprise Adam felt on coming to consciousness as a grown man, being placed in Eden with the breath of life fresh in his nostrils. Adam, more than any other epic hero, begins in medias res, in the middle of things, as epic poems typically begin. We might feel with Adam the sensation of being placed in a deep sleep, and awaken once again to the beauty of Eve, clothed in the glory of the Lord. And we might imagine the horror he felt on seeing the world through fallen eyes, of learning, as F. Scott Fitzgerald would later put it, what a grotesque thing a rose is, and how raw the sunlight was upon the scarcely created grass. Twice now, in the first 3 tercets, we have heard of this lost via, the way that Dante now finds barred. Again, we hear immediate echoes of both the classical and Christian traditions. For Christ is the way, the truth Dante has abandoned, the life he has nearly forsaken as he stumbles toward the underworld. This true way is intimately linked to the Aristotelian understanding of nature, the organizational principle which directs everything that makes a thing what it is to that thing's end. This concept will prove immensely useful to Dante in constructing his comedic vision of the universe, in which everything is placed according to the degree to which it fulfills its nature. Thus, we will meet Satan at the physical center of the universe, as far as ontologically possible away from God, who himself is the ontological center of the universe, with every soul we meet along the way falling into that hierarchy. It will be hard for Dante to tell us of this journey, as it is hard for all of us to describe our journey through sin, but he will do so for the sake of the good he ultimately finds. Looking back upon the past he has just left, Dante employs the first of his poem's epic similes, comparing himself to one who escapes from the fury of the sea to the shore. On a literary level, this is a clear allusion to Virgil's Aeneid, the first of many connections drawn between Dante the pilgrim and Aeneas the hero. Again, though, there are also echoes of the terrors of the unformed deep of Genesis, the fury of the flood, the storm that threatens to overwhelm the apostles as Christ sleeps in the stern of their boat. Here, too, Dante's language keeps us off balance, as if he is asking us whether we're paying attention. He speaks of his soul as escaping the past no living person ever left, leading us to ask whether he is still alive. And indeed, the Inferno describes a kind of journey through death. However, he refers again to his weary body, assuring us that he is still alive, though perhaps very much in danger. We see then that practically every line of Dante's work is multivalent. He contains multitudes, to borrow from Walt Whitman. And in channeling these several resonances from the classical and Christian traditions, Dante invites us to be interpreters with him, to share with him the task of seeing the word which penetrates the world and our own words. It is worth remembering that Dante is in many ways following St. Thomas's advice that words may have both literal and spiritual meanings, with the spiritual divisible into the allegorical, the moral, and the anagogical. It belongs to us, recognizing the cohesion of meanings possible in each word, to enter imaginatively into the reality Dante sets before us. In the midst of this imaginative vortex, though, we can't lose sight of the existential anguish Dante feels, the sense of having lost the right road, a sense we know all too well. And indeed, having awakened in the wood, Dante now has reason to hope. For above him, clothing the shoulders of a hill, he sees the rays of the sun. He does not see the sun itself, as indeed he will not throughout Inferno. Yet its light gives him hope, and he begins to ascend the mountain, trying to return to the right way and attain his end. With his firm foot, perhaps representing what measure of virtue he retains, ever the lower, driving him upward in his desperate ascent, he seeks to attain the summit, which the commentary tradition takes to represent not the true end of man's life in heaven, but rather the sort of good life available to the virtuous pagan, a life illuminated by the sun of virtue, but not by the full light of the Lamb who lights the heavenly Jerusalem. Having pressed us early to begin our interpretive grappling with the poem, Dante proceeds to set us one of the most critically vexed questions in the history of poetry. He sees the sun clothing the rays of a hill in its salutary light, and attempts to ascend, to return insofar as within his power to the right way. Hardly has he begun the climb, though, when he is beset by three creatures, a lion, a leopard, and a wolf, which ultimately drives him down to the lonely plain at the verge of the forest. The leopard, described as having a spotted pelt, recalls the description of a lynx used in Virgil's Aeneid. And while it frightens Dante, he remains hopeful. Morning is coming, spring is at hand, and Good Friday is on its way. Now, even an animal has sufficient imagination, that is, the capacity to internalize and react to images, to recognize the danger of these three beasts. St. Thomas calls this capacity the estimative sense. For the human imagination, and especially the Catholic imagination, these bestial threats become also opportunities for development of many levels of symbolic value. We recall, for instance, the many mentions of these three animals in Scripture. Jeremiah tells us, "Therefore a lion from the forest will slay them, A wolf of the deserts will destroy them. A leopard is watching their cities. Isaiah gives us the famous image of the wolf dwelling with the lamb, the leopard with the young goat, and the calf with the young lion. St. Peter warns us of the devil going about like a roaring lion, and Christ bids us beware the wolves. There's more here, though, for in Dante the imagination is shaped not only by scripture, but also, of course, by the classical tradition. And from the earliest to the most recent commentators, the assumption has been that more than simply creating elusive scriptural resonances, Dante also means his three beasts as allegorical figures. But what is the allegory? Plainly, the beasts represent those forces which prevent Dante from ascending the hill to the good life under his own power. And in Italian, Dante alliteratively links the three beasts with each other, l'onza, leone, lupe, and with Satan, Lucifer. Do these three beasts then represent sins which particularly plague Dante or his time? Many of the first commentators saw in them figures of pride, lust, and avarice, or pride, treachery, and gluttony. Still others have found in them reference to the threefold Aristotelian division of vice, which will govern much of the structure of Dante's hell: incontinence, malice, and mad bestiality. For our own part, we might suggest that the leopard represents fraud, a category of sin which seems to plague Dante little. Indeed, we will hear later, at the mouth of the pit of fraud, that Dante uses his Franciscan cincture to try to capture the leopard. The lion, with its head held high and its rabid hunger, might well represent pride and gluttony. And the wolf, so lean and ferocious, may be taken to embody envy, avarice, and wrath. No definite consensus has arisen among the scholars on this question, and while some of us may feel frustrated with Dante's apparent failure to give us a pat answer, it is perhaps worth considering that here, at the outset of a poem, which will very often bring us to the limits of human reason and language, Dante gives us an initial example of the elasticity of the human imagination. It is not that, in some nominalist way, Dante wants to give us carte blanche to assign whatever meanings we want to the images he supplies. Rather, he allows our minds to dwell upon a range of related symbolic valences which reflect the poem's ever-deepening textural resonances as well as our imagination's ever-expansive capacity, a capacity Dante will stretch to the utmost as he leads us to a vision of the Trinity. There we will see the goodness of man reflected in the face of Christ. Here, in the visages of these three animals, we see the marks of man's fall. Dante the pilgrim, at any rate, is vanquished, driven back nel gran deserta, that is, into the great empty plain at the edge of the forest. And in Dante's phrase, we may hear an echo of the choron macron into which the prodigal son wanders, the big emptiness, often translated as a far-off country. He has lost hope of ascending under his own power, and he reflects on his despair with another simile, comparing himself to a gambler who has somehow lost all. This is the situation we all know when we gamble on sin. Dante descends to where the sun is silent. The synesthetic description both displays Dante's confusion and reminds us of the way in which following the will of the Father, our Son, the one who lights our way, is a matter of quieting the heart and listening. In the emptiness to which Dante returns, the poem somehow becomes even stranger, for there in the wide silence we meet Virgil, the great Roman poet, author of the Aeneid and the Georgics and the Eclogues. Here, as Dante cries out to this vision, unsure if he sees only another shade among the shadows or a living man, it is worth pointing out once more how Dante prompts us at every turn to join in the act of interpretation. We, too, are meant to wonder what's going on here. Out of this place where the sun is silent emerges a figure who can't possibly be here before us, and yet here he is, offering us the divine grace which he himself lacked, and without which even the greatest pagan virtue is ineffectual. It is worth noting, too, that Dante's cry begins with a Latin word from the Psalms, miserere, have mercy. Though he has chosen to write his poem in the vernacular, he reminds both his interlocutor and his reader that he is conversant in the ancient language of Rome. Virgil's response sets a pattern Dante will follow for the majority of the poem, in that he rarely gives us straightforward answers to questions of identity. Instead of naming himself, Virgil describes himself by several traits, though admittedly unmistakable ones. He was a man, but has lost his manhood. In him, Dante cannot quite see flesh of his flesh, as Adam saw in Eve. We learn of this stranger further that he was Mantuan. He lived under the reign of Augustus, and he sang the son of Anchises, that is, Aeneas. He presents himself as a man who lived at the very height of Roman power and looked poetically into the roots of that power. Yet even his great gifts could not avail him of the benefits of the true Rome, which would arise not under Julius, not under Caesar, but under Peter. Dante guesses rightly that this is Virgil, that fountain pouring forth so rich a flow of speech. He is not quite a font of living water well enough to eternal life, though. He goes on to praise Virgil as the light of all other poets, though we will see Homer named the king of poets soon, and he describes him as his master and maker. Materially, Virgil's poetry has proven the chief influence on Dante's, reminding us again of the importance of the Latin language. But the description of Virgil thus may also point both to the inadequacy of Dante's moral state at this point in the poem, and to the importance of Virgil's arrival. For we must ask ourselves, why Virgil? Why not a guardian angel? Why not a saint? Frankly, the answer may in part be simply that Dante the poet wanted it this way, that he loved Virgil and wanted to revive in his generation a poet who had become for many of the people of Dante's time someone like Dante or Shakespeare might be for us, a task to be dreaded rather than a master to be imitated and admired. And it may be that Virgil, who is sent nonetheless by divine command under the intercession of Mary, is in the moment the ideal guide, the one who can meet Dante where he is and, in his very fallibility, ultimately show Dante that he needs more than poetry to attain heaven. Indeed, Virgil himself proposes that Dante follow him, first through an endless place, hell. Again, Dante rarely names something for us, but asks us to learn the names of things better by learning the reality of the things named. And then through the place where souls in anguish nonetheless wait in hope, purgatory. After that, another guide will be needed. This will be Beatrice, who will guide Dante into paradise, a place Virgil cannot go, since he was a rebel to the law of the Emperor on high, the true Augustus, the one whose praises Virgil will eternally wish he had sung. So Virgil goes on, and Dante comes close behind. Thanks for joining me for this episode of the Dante in a Year podcast. See you next time as we explore Dante's Inferno, Canto 2.